Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for Monday, June the 21st, 2021. We're at summer already. Boy, this year is flying by. This is Air Force veteran David Corey along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. We're hoping to have a special guest this evening, Marine Corps veteran Mark Ledlow. We're having a little difficulty reaching him. Hopefully he'll be able to join us soon. Mark is an expert in the security industry, and if we can connect with him this evening, he'll share his insights about the security business. First, though, let's go to my co-host, Richard Hurley. Rick, how are things going in North Central Florida?
Hey, David. Good. Everything's really good. We're getting Florida's starting to heat up a little bit, but that's expected in the summertime of Florida. We've had a pretty good season so far weather-wise. I want to remind everybody that this is a call-in show. That number is 1-888-627-6008. Again, 1-888-627-6008. And during the show, we'll remind everyone of that number again. We're still waiting for Mark. David, I thought I would just chime in. You know, I've been doing a lot of Board of Veteran Appeals hearings lately. And I mean a lot. and I just wanted to kind of share something that is real evident now when I'm getting in front of the different judges. They all tend to have one common theme. And after they listen to the veteran talk and they listen to me go through the legal arguments, they come back to the three elements that have to be proven. You know, first, they're looking to see whether or not there was an event in service that caused the particular disability, whether it's a mental condition, exposed to combat, or you hurt your knee, or you hurt your shoulder, or something happened. So you need element number one. Then number two, were you diagnosed? Was the veteran ever diagnosed and or treated for that particular disability? And that could be something that was done at the VA, possibly, or through your own private doctor. And then the third element is, what is your current condition? You know, as a result of this disability, do you suffer from it? So these, you know, the judges are really kind of, when you have these nice hearings, they jump right back to that, and they want to make a point to the veteran that these are the three elements that have to be proven in order to substantiate a claim. So I'm just telling, I want to shoot that out to you veterans who are, maybe you're at the BVA level now and you've got a representative helping you out. You might have an attorney helping you out. Hopefully the attorney knows what he needs to do along these lines. But those are the three things that you want to make sure that you get across to the judge. And one of the things that David and I do all the time, it's routine, is we will have the veteran prepare a statement, and in that statement these three elements will then be discussed in detail. So that's one of the things I wanted to bring up. And then the other thing I wanted to bring up is, when you get ready for your hearing, and I'm seeing this more and more, and it's mind-boggling, and David, you might want to jump in on this one, is sure. when you read the VA decision, and the VA will say something like, I'm paraphrasing, let's use PTSD as an example. They'll deny PTSD by saying there's not an event in service to service connected. And then they'll go through a litany of stuff within the body of the decision. And then at the very end, they'll say favorable findings. You always need to look at that favorable findings, because in there, more often than not, you'll see something like, the veteran was diagnosed with anxiety, PTSD. And, you know, I sit there. This has happened to me now over the last dozen or so hearings, almost every time on different issues. And I look at the judge. I'm like, Judge, they're denying him. Yet at the end of that that particular disability condition, they're admitting that you were diagnosed with it. So you have to look for that, because then that the judges are jumping on that as well. It's like, I don't understand what the VA is doing. First they're denying it, saying there's no service connection, and then at the very end they're saying, well, there's a favorable finding that you were in fact diagnosed with PTSD.
Yeah.
And then all you got to do is link that PTSD back to the event that happened in service, and you're good to go. I mean, it's almost an automatic remand. Your thoughts, David?
No, that's a great point, because I've heard judges emphasize the same thing, those three points, that there has to be something in the service that happened, there has to be a current disability, and then there's got to be the connection between the two. And what I've seen in some cases, you know, because I think, Rick, we tend to get in our work to represent veterans, we tend to get the tougher cases. Why? For obvious reasons. If there were simple cases, you know, they would have won either representing themselves or with a veteran service officer. But the tougher cases often include veterans who did not file until years had passed after they left the service, you know, and they might have PTSD, they might have depression, anxiety, but let's say they left the service 20 years ago. In the interim, in those 20 years, they may have experienced lots of other trauma or other reasons that sort of complicated, you know what I mean? This is like a lot of other problems in their life contributing to their current situation. So having to sort out and to show that whatever they have now is due to the service, not due to something else. And, you know, that's where this nexus argument. The other thing that we see, you know, hearing loss is probably the most common, single most common disability that the VA compensates veterans for. And in some cases, it may be pretty obvious. They were exposed to a lot of noise. And, you know, they experienced a hearing loss that they can document with testing. And it seems clear that was really the only noise exposure, and it was relatively short in time since they left the service. But when you have veterans that, you know, many, many, many decades later say my hearing loss is due to the service, you know, the VA comes back and says, well, it's due to old age, having nothing to do with the service. So veterans tend to overlook that, which is why I think judges feel like they have to bring up that point. You know, there's those three basic elements, current disability, but there has to be a connection between the disability and something in the service. It's not simply that you've got a disability. So, yeah, I think it's super important, like you say, Rick, that to keep that big picture in mind, that medical nexus opinion in tough cases sometimes requires going and finding a private doctor expert. And of course, their opinion, the strength of their opinion depends on whether or not they reviewed the entire claims file, and also the reasoning, the rationale that they provide. It can't just be one or two sentence conclusions saying, yes, it's due to the service. They have to explain why that is, particularly, and this is, you know, we've often talked on the show about Agent Orange and the presumptive list of cancers and other diseases due to Agent Orange, but it is possible to service connect other disabilities that aren't on that list, but that's where you need a really strong opinion, medical opinion from an expert. I've had cases like that too. But anyway, I know, Rick, you've had just probably a record-setting number of hearings in the last year. What are some of your other impressions about the BVA and these virtual hearings?
Here's another thing. This is kind of an easy one, I think. A lot of times my clients will say to me, because remember, these are done virtually, so it's not like you're in a courtroom setting or even down in St. Pete where you have a huge screen. You're doing these, you know, my monitor is pretty big. It's not just my laptop. It's a big monitor. So we're on that. So the veterans will always say, what should I wear? And I don't know how you feel about this, David, but what I always tell the veteran is, what I want you to wear what makes you feel comfortable. You know, I don't want you to show up in rags, obviously, but you don't need a suit and tie. I wear a suit and tie, but you don't need to wear a suit and tie. But I want you to show up in something that makes you feel comfortable. Something that's kind of, you know, you're making an impression on these judges, something that might be impressionable so that the judge has an idea of who Mr. or Mrs. Smith is. Some of my clients dress up real nice. Others come in with a t-shirt, nice t-shirt. And that's fine too. It's part of the presentation. So that's one thing. Another thing, that is when we've talked about this a little bit and is the, if you're in the AMA system, which is the new system, as opposed to the legacy system, which is the old system, then it's very possible.
And AMA stands for the Appeals Modernization Act, by the way.
Right. And it's very possible that whichever judge hears your case may not be the judge who's going to decide your case. And as crazy as that sounds, now last Friday I had a hearing. And, you know, I always bring this up during the hearing or before the hearing so my client understands the ramifications. And in this particular case, I asked the judge, I said, you know, I know there's some controversy going on. How do you feel about it? And he gave me an answer that was a little more satisfactory to me because as an old-time litigator, I firmly believe that when you're arguing a case in front of a judge, that judge should be the one who's going to decide your case. He sees you. He gets an impression about you. So what this judge said was that there are so many new judges that with the older judges, if the older judges are able to keep their caseload under control, and this judge said he usually does that. So most of his cases come back to him. But he said some of the other judges are unable to you know, keep control of their calendar. They've been around a long time. They got a lot of cases they have to decide, and they just can't do it. So now you've got about a lot of new judges in the system who don't have a big calendar load. So with this new system of letting other judges hear another judge's case, that's the point. That's really the purpose, is to free up the judges who have been around a while, have a huge caseload, and you got newer judges who don't have that extensive caseload. So now you're filtering cases down to that new judge. So, you know, when I heard that on Friday, I thought that was a reasonable response to my criticism, why I think the judge that hears the case should be the one to decide the case.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have a client now who's got three different appeals going with the board. And 2 years ago this month, we had a hearing. This is pre-COVID. The hearing was at the St. Petersburg Regional Office, you know, on a big screen. It was a video, but it was a big screen there at the regional office. And what was amazing about that case was that rather than having to wait months and months after the hearing for a decision, the judge made a decision that was dated a week after the hearing, and we got it in the mail of just a few weeks after that. That was like record time. And that issue has been the subject of, and it was ended up being a grant on one issue and a remand on another issue. Well, the issue that was remanded has now had two subsequent remands by the same judge. So the same judge has kept those issues associated with that hearing from 2 years ago. All right. And this was under the legacy, the pre-Appeals Modernization Act. And what's unfortunate about that case is the issue that was remanded for another medical opinion when it first went back to regional office level, they were required to get a new medical opinion. And they got a doctor whose medical practice was in allergies. And the veteran's condition required a specialist in spinal issues. It was absurd that, you know. And we easily got that overturned. Then they got another specialist who was almost as equally unqualified, made another negative decision, got that overturned. You know, then it went back to the board, got another remand for another opinion. Now the opinions come back equally flawed. So it's going to go back to this same judge that we first had a hearing on 2 years ago. So this is a major issue for this veteran. 2 years later, you know, this issue is still kicking around. Why? Because of VA incompetences. And as I'm arguing now, I think it's a case of among other problems, bad faith on the part of the VA, the way they are handling the remand. But anyway, the same veteran has two other appeals. One that is also under the legacy system, the pre-AMA, and we had a hearing for that with a different judge about 2 weeks ago. So that judge, what was amazing was that judge, you know, Rick, usually the judges don't tip their hands, usually. Sometimes they will, but this judge actually told us at the end of the hearing that he was going to grant what we were seeking, and which was wonderful. Now, of course, it's still going to take probably months before we get the decision in writing, but he basically tipped his hand. But this veteran, the same veteran, also has had several other issues on appeal under the new program, the AMA program, the Imperial Modernization Act. So we're going to be entitled to another hearing, which we requested, on those additional issues, probably with, you know, or at least possibly with a third judge. So you have three different judges for this same veteran, stretched out over, you know, quite a long time. And we'll have to see how it all boils down, because ultimately the veteran's goal is, in this case, is to get all these conditions service-connected and to get aid and attendance, higher special monthly compensation, those sort of things. There's a lot at stake for this veteran. And it is sort of interesting to see, Rick, and I know you've seen this, you know, the different approaches taken by judges. Most judges will not tip their hands. You know, they won't let you really. I mean, you can get sometimes a sense of how they're looking at things by the questions they ask or blatant comments they make, but very rarely do they say, okay, I'm going to go ahead and do this. I'm going to go ahead, and especially with a grant, you know, they might say, I'm going to remand it. They might kind of tip that, but to actually say, well, I'm going to go ahead and grant that issue doesn't happen. But in any event, yeah, but I applaud the BVA, the Board of Veterans Appeals, because I think in the last couple years that they've really done a great job in implementing this Appeals Modernization Act. They did a far better job than I think we had reason to expect, given the BVA's history, you know, before that.
I think there's a reason for that, and that is that I think the BVA is understanding the frustration that the veteran is experiencing with the VA. You know,
I think it's leadership.
But I listened to, for instance, on the C-Files, when I tell the judge, you know, judge, I haven't received the C file yet. Now the BVA is not supposed to, you have 90 days to supply additional evidence. You have that 90 day window to supply additional evidence. Now, if you have not received the C file, the BVA will not start, unless you say it's okay, will not start the running of the 90 days until you get the C file. So that's one thing, and they will order it. I mean, I've had many situations lately where the board is, they put that in their order, and then I've gotten a phone call within a week or so from someone at the VA saying, that doesn't happen a lot, but saying, I'm here, I'm putting together the C file for Mr. Smith. And I'm like, oh, that's great. But the BVA was the one who was instrumental in getting me the C file. And they're very critical of the VA and they're very critical when, you know, you see a veteran getting up to 80-90%. And when you see the issues that are before the Board of Veteran Appeals, and you can see they're, you know, wondering why they didn't dip it over into 100% when clearly it could have been 100%. So I think the BVA is a little frustrated by the VA.
Well, the BVA is part of the VA. You know, it's not.
No, I understand that, but they're part of the VA for sure. But they're also policing the VA and all the VA's mistakes, which is plentiful. Another thing that and sometimes a judge will criticize you'll have maybe three streams during the appeal. And different judges will do different things. Some judges will just do all three streams under the same recording because everything's recorded. Some judges will turn the recorder off and come back and start fresh with the new stream and do that. So different judges have different ways of doing it. But one judge I could see he was kind of frustrated that we have these different streams because they're caused by the fact that you're filing different claims throughout the process of that veteran's claim process. And I had to, you know, turn around to a judge and say, well, judge, the VA is creating that problem, not the lawyer. When a lawyer files 10 claims, and this happens all the time, I don't know about you, David, but with me, this happens all the time, 100% across the board. They make a decision on 5 of those claims, and they're silent on the other 5. And then 2 months later, they make another decision on the other 5 claims. Now, my practice is the moment I get the decision in, if I'm going to appeal it, I file the appeal right away. I'm not going to wait around for the VA to do the other 5 claims. I'm going to file the appeal for the claims that came in because for me personally, I've got to get that off my desk. If I sit around and wait, and I don't have a tickler in my brain to go back 2 months and say, oh, you know, I got to file Mr. Smith's appeals. It's been 3 months. For me personally, I've got to get it out the door. So I ended up, because of that process, I ended up creating that multiple streamline process during the BVA hearing. And I would say most of the time the judges have no problem with it. But every so often I've had a judge say, you know, well, we're having this, we have to keep doing this because of the way these things are filed. And I would remind the judge, I file them the way the VA decides them. If they decide all the claims the first time around, you file 20-0995, you file 10 claims and all 10 come back, fine. But right. So far that doesn't seem to be happening. The VA is not, and I think that's just because they're sending the veteran out to different C&P exams. Those exams come back before some of the other ones come back. And then who's ever interpreting those exams then makes the decision, and they're not waiting around for all 10 claims to come in. So,
yeah, you can make an argument that the VA's practice of deciding some issues as soon as they can and then deferring ones that aren't ready is actually helping the veterans in some way because it's getting them money sooner. You know what I mean? If there's a dozen issues on a claim and 6 of them they can grant very quickly, why hold those up for 6 months as they're gathering more information? I see that in one of the cases I have right now where they've granted or denied about 6 issues and they've deferred about 6 others, and then they followed up on one of the more complex issues that was deferred with a follow up kind of duty to assist issue telling us specifically what their concern was, which was interesting, because usually, you know, in years past with a regional office, you don't get that sort of transparency. You know, you don't get that level of communication. But but it does become frustrating, you know, keeping track of if you got a dozen issues and they've been decided over the course of 6 or 8 months and multiple decisions. It becomes logistically a problem too, because like you say, you may not have a judge that's willing to handle all of them at one time, or you know. Anyway, but it's there's a lot to this to keep things going. Well, we haven't heard from our guest. For those of you that may have tuned in hoping to hear our guest, our expected guest this evening was Marine Corps veteran Mark Ledlow, works in the security industry. Not sure what happened, but he's maybe we'll get him back on a future show. But I'll just tell you briefly in case any of you want to read up on it. Mark's a Marine Corps veteran, former law enforcement officer, and he's the CEO of Ledlow Security Group. His mission and his work is to help put veterans to work in the growing security industry. In addition to being CEO of Ledlow Security Group, Mark Ledlow is also the host of a podcast called the Fearless Mindset Podcast, and he's interviewed experts in security from former FBI agents, CIA agents, independent security agencies, and even CEOs of cybersecurity firms. So check out his websites, which are the following: fearlessmindsetpodcast.com. That's a long one. fearlessmindsetpodcast.com, and also his company website, which is Ledlow Security, Ledlow, L-E-D-L-O-W, security.com. So hopefully we'll get Mark Ledlow on one of our future shows, because I think he's got a lot of interesting stuff to share about the growing security business, as well as sharing his own insights from having served in the Marine Corps.
Hey, David, I got something for you.
Go ahead.
One of the things that you do for our firm, and we haven't really talked about it in a long time, are these discharge upgrades.
Right.
And I know, we've been getting a lot of those lately. And, why don't you give us a brief summary or rundown of what you're looking for when you take one of these cases on?
Well, for instance, those that have served know that many of the people, and this amounts to tens of thousands every year that are discharged from the military, are discharged with a discharge characterization of something other than an honorable discharge, and there are a number of different classifications of those discharges. There's two major groups. One is administrative discharge, and the other one is a punitive discharge. The punitive can only be issued by a court martial. And it gets very complicated because the character of discharge, and whether it's administrative or a court martial, can then significantly affect what steps you take to get that upgraded. You might say, well, what's the point? Well, what's at stake? What's at stake for these veterans or VA benefits? So, Rick, I just heard from our producer that Mark Ledlow has joined us.
I heard that too.
To Mark. Yeah. I'd like to welcome Mark to our show. Mark, good to hear from you.
Sorry about that. I'm out in the country here, so I had to get back in the reception area.
Okay, well, let me introduce you for our guest, and then we can launch right into your interview. Mark Ledlow is a Marine Corps veteran, former law enforcement officer, and he's the CEO of Ledlow Security Group. Mark is on a mission to help put 10,000 veterans to work in the growing security industry, and in addition to being CEO of Ledlow Security Group, Mark Ledlow is also the host of the Fearless Mindset Podcast, where he's interviewed experts in security, including former FBI agents, CIA agents, and members of various independent agencies, as well as CEOs of cybersecurity firms. His websites are fearlessmindsetpodcast.com, where you can listen to his archived interviews, and also ledlowsecurity.com. So without further ado, let's welcome Mark Ledlow to the Veterans NewsHour. Mark, how are you tonight?
Hey, can't complain. I'm blessed, and I'm an American. I'm a Marine Corps veteran, and it could always be worse, but I'm doing pretty good, and looking forward to getting out of this COVID-19, getting back to reality, getting back to life.
Oh, amen. I understand that. So thanks for being with us tonight. Now, since our show's main audience is veterans and their families, let's get started by, if you could just tell us just a bit about your own military experience in the Marine Corps and then how you got into the security business after your military service.
Yeah, that's a great question. During my time in the Marine Corps, it kind of sucked. They say hell week for the buds sucks for Navy SEALs. And, you go through that process becoming a Marine, and then you go to your mission school, and you're going through that journey of trying to figure out who you are. E1 to E4 is always it's a tough route because you're trying to get your identity. You're in your 20s, and you're trying to figure stuff out. And, it definitely gave me the foundation to network and be comfortable in my own skin, and discipline it teaches you. And the biggest thing is getting the mission accomplished. And that's probably the biggest thing I took away from the Marine Corps is getting things done. And it's funny, I'll give you an example. When I was in college, I was like academic probation. I just sucked as being a student. But whatever it was in the Marine Corps, got on the reserve side and went back to school, and then I was on D's list in 4.0.
Wow.
So it definitely flipped a switch in my brain to give me more fierce focus than what I had before going to the military. I couldn't focus, and it helped me create a focus energy into my studies to get my bachelor's degree and all that. But the Marine Corps, discipline and tenacity and just stay in the grind and get stuff done. And then, I think a lot of my journey was after I got my degree, went corporate side, corporate America, where I was a regional account executive for WaMu before it became Chase Bank. I learned, the art of networking, business development, chasing down contracts, getting business. And that definitely laid the foundation from that corporate side. Then we had 2008, the market crashed. And when that happened, I decided, I'm going to move back to Southern California and jump in the security industry back in 2008. And I think it's 15 years later, here we are. And I think that foundation, the corporate America and the foundation of the Marine Corps, gave me the ingredients and the skill set to, create a business of, security, providing security services to high net worth individuals. And, the people that, got me through those doors were, Robert Dodge, which former president of corporate risk G4S, and Michael Trott with former CIA. He was the head of security, but the part of the security team were directors George Tenet and some Navy SEALs that I've known, and many others that opened up the doorway for me because I served in the Marine Corps. And you don't know that when you're in it, but the doors that open to you later on in life, if I can say anything to the vets listening to this or families, it's just crazy the opportunity to present themselves to you because you served in the Marine Corps or in the military for that matter.
Right. Mark, let me ask you, what's it been like to work in executive protection with top-level celebrities and foreign dignitaries?
They're two different animals. They're two different beasts. You get in the celebrity world, the celebrity principal can definitely be nice people, but you always had the staff around that celebrity that are jousting for position of power and influence. And I found them often kind of toxic, but the dignitary is totally opposite from celebrity because the dignitary, if they're on non-official business, then usually they hire private security for protection, usually for their family, especially if they're, LA market, they're going to medical treatment or they're just on vacation. So they don't warrant State Department or Secret Service for that matter because they're on non-official business. And working with the families are typically, they're fun, they're enjoyable because they take care of you. I often find the celebrities that they don't give a, they don't care really. They don't, you're there, you're like hired help. But the dignitaries, they seem to be more respectful of their, especially military guys with backgrounds because they know they got their back. And they typically, the chief of staffs usually take care of you. Their executive assistants are all about taking care of their security agents. We call it executive protection. Most people in the civilian world call it bodyguard, but the technical term would be executive protection or close protection agent. And those guys are usually pretty good people, the chief of staff. But the family, the dignitaries are definitely easier to work with. They're just more fluid. They have a usually security programs in place versus the celebrities are hiring their buddy to be a bodyguard. You have liability issues. You have risk issues. You know, we know how the Kardashians turned out. I think they've been through 100 different companies that service them. And usually if I'm offered a celebrity, I'll say no. If I'm offered a dignitary, I'll say yes, because I just know it's more professional. They treat you more professional anyway.
I see. Now, as someone that really doesn't know much about that industry, I'm going to ask you just kind of a basic question about what these security details are like how large are they, and how do you, as a CEO, how do you go about managing what would be a large security detail? Can you just give us sort of a word picture of what that's like?
Well, I just recently got my security licensing in Oregon. Before that, I was partnered with some other people in California, so I want to set the record correctly. I became the CEO of Ludlow Associates LLC in Oregon, but I partnered with other people in California who had licenses and were, you know, people worked under their umbrella or, so to speak, their flag. So I want to make sure we make the correction there, is that I want to give myself more of a credit than credits deserve. And what I found is some of these higher profile details, for example, I'm not going to name who the clients were because I signed non-disclosure agreements and non-compete. So I'll just consider them Middle East royal families. And what I found is they were the size of the detail were comparable to the Secret Service of the president at that given time. And that family was from the Middle East. And the guys that were running one was actually under Mike Trott's direction, under his leadership, with Phil Hackison over in Washington, D.C. Both these guys were, you know, one was CIA, one was Secret Service. And I definitely can tell they knew how to lead from the front. And they didn't show any stress on their face. You know, we had a mission to do, and, you know, people were getting fired left and right because they're incompetent in what they're doing. But the biggest thing I learned is you surround yourself with people that are smarter than you and better than you on different things, and that's how you survive. And it's definitely a team effort, and it's about like how you know the SEAL team runs. You know, everybody's got a skill set, and that's how they survive their mission. But I would definitely say it's all that leadership. Everything rises and falls based on leadership.
I see. Well, that makes sense. Now, I don't want you to when I ask you this next question, I don't want you to have to. I'd ask you to divulge anything that would compromise your security protocols, but I would just kind of get a sense of like what would be considered a large security detail. If you had a foreign dignitary and his family on vacation in Southern California, for instance, and they needed a security detail, if you can answer the question, fine. If not, I'd understand too. But what would be like a large security detail? And I ask maybe in the context of if you're trying to recruit vets into this industry, kind of give them an idea of what the job is like.
My position was, I was with the grandson of the principal, and he was just a kid, and he was easy. We just went to the park a lot, but that family there, they were probably, I think we had a total of up to 50 on that one in Beverly Hills, and it was crazy because there's so many moving parts. And the biggest thing that kept us going, running smoothly, is using different communication texting abilities. And that's usually how we stayed in contact with each other, because the mom would go, hey, we're so-and-so, or we're so-and-so, and then go, hey, we're at XYZ location in Beverly Hills. And that's probably, I think the size of it was probably, I think it was half females on that thing. And that was probably the largest detail I've been on that was half females. That, you know, the females are just great communicators in the industry, and they're up and coming. There's some really strong skill sets with the ladies out there. And believe it or not, because you're dealing with Sharia law, it's kind of the culture for women to be with women and men to be with men to be with men and women to be with women. So you're dealing with that Sharia law. So you'll see that more so with that culture than anywhere else. But that was probably, I think, a 50 to 60 person detail. Largest one I've ever been on.
Wow.
And you have moving parts. You have somebody flying here to a different state for just to go shopping. They get a private jet. They're going to jump on a private jet, take off to do their thing. And I think there's so many things going on. I just go to the park with my principal, and then we go back to the hotel. He goes hang out with his dad.
Oh.
But it was pretty crazy. Just a lot of moving parts. it's just, yeah, it's identical to that of the Secret Service, the president, you know, in our movements.
Right. Now, again, without asking you to reveal any confidential information that would jeopardize your clients, but how do you go about assessing the threats that might be relevant, basically, you know, that would then maybe drive the size of the security detail? Because I know you, in the introduction, I mentioned that, you know, you've worked with former FBI, CIA, and others. How do you go about assessing what the threats are?
Well, that's a good question. Like I was reading Mike Trott's book, Be Protected. For anybody who's looking to get into business, I highly recommend his book. He's a good friend of mine and a mentor of mine. And in that book, it breaks down the different circles, the threats and all that. And any client, like that's family looking at possibly getting security, they need to have a threat assessment, risk assessment done to see what truly are the threats. Are they global? Are they known terror cells? And there's a thing called geofencing that you can get into. Different companies offer it. I know Ontic does a lot of risk assessment, threat assessment. That's kind of what they do. They sell that end user product to the Fortune 100 to 500 companies. And that's kind of what they do for, you know, professionally. And you can get, you know, I know they use a lot of FBI guys, a lot of former Secret Service are known to have that strong skill set of doing a risk assessment, threat assessment, to figure out what those legitimate threats are. Are they just social media threats? Or is the client kids? Do they have a million, you know, 20 million followers? Are they going to post that they're at, I don't know, down in Malibu having dinner at a local restaurant? And are they going to tag themselves? And if they tag themselves, oh, well, you have a problem. You have paparazzi showing up everywhere. So a lot of it's, you know, nowadays it's social media threats, not just getting kidnapped by cartel or something like that. But it's actually the kids creating their own problem because they're on social media and, you know, they all want to be famous and they're already famous usually, but they have that lifestyle that's alluring and they start tagging themselves, geotagging themselves, and you have new problems and new issues.
Yeah, and I don't think most members of the general public, you know, those of us that that are not well-known or famous, which is the majority of people, that they maybe really don't appreciate, the kinds of threats and stalking and death threats and other things that a lot of celebrities get just as part of, now I realize they welcome the positive side of being a celebrity, but maybe you can speak to that as far as, you know, just under the general topic of threats. I know you mentioned before, you know, security for dignitaries and then also security for celebrities, maybe different types of threats, but maybe if you could speak to that, because I think most people just don't realize the sorts of threats that a lot of celebrities face.
Well, yeah, you're right, because like, for example, let's take the first case scenario with Kardashians. You know, she was robbed in England, right? And then the bodyguard that was protecting her, he was protecting multiple people. So the celebrities need to listen to their trusted advisor, whoever that security firm is, a security company, whoever's advising them. The problem with celebrities, they don't want to listen. And you have to remember, they get paid by publicity, right? They're public relations. So most times celebrities are actually setting themselves up with the paparazzi. Somebody within the celebrity camp, their staff is calling the TMZ up, say, hey, we're going to be XYZ here down in Rodeo Drive. Take pictures of us. We'll show up at 2:00. And the security guys don't even have a clue to what's going on. And then they show up and here's all the paparazzi lined up, and they actually staged most of that stuff, believe it or not.
Wow.
And that's all.
Wow.
But that's all for TMZ. That's for publicity, because they get, you know, people making money off that, and then it helps with their ranking and social media influence. So a lot of that is self-inflicted by the celebrities. That's just their world. That's how they live.
Right. It's sort of a risk management, though. They don't want to get themselves hurt either. Now, now, Mark, I don't want to hog the interview here. My co-host Rick Hurley is with us. Rick, if you want to chime in, you might have some questions for Mark as well. Rick?
Yeah. Hey, Mark. I was just
hey, Rick.
Thinking about what you were saying about the celebrities. And, you know, I would think that you would have to, you know, when you initially meet them, kind of have this coming to Jesus moments, telling these people, now this is what I'm going to do, and this is what I expect of you, so that I can protect you.
Right.
And it sounds like you know, even when you have that come Jesus moment, the celebrity in the back of their mind saying, well, that's all great, Mark, but, you know, I got my own thing going on here. And it sounds like you're almost out of the loop.
Yeah, you are, because most of them treat you like you're the adopted stepchild. They call it the adopted stepchild syndrome. It's how the survey looks at you. You're hired help. You're like a staff. They have no regard for you. I mean, I know the guys, most of the guys are working for the Kardashian detail. And, you know, I'm not going to say who they were, but I know one guy personally. He said after a week, he pulled his entire team off because they weren't, one of them were refusing to give their guys bathroom breaks. I'm like, really? Yeah, they treat us like dogs. So guess what? Let them figure it out. Let them get, you know, held up at gunpoint. Maybe they'll respect the guys that are former military, former police officers. Maybe they'll actually show a little more respect because they, right now, they don't respect anybody. They have that so much esteem of themselves. They just have that whole sense of security because I am so-and-so. You know, I'm a celebrity. I'm an A-lister. Well, you'll think of that twice when the guy has a gun to your head asking for your money and your jewelry.
When you get a veteran that wants to come on and be part of your team, what's the kind of training that they go through? I mean, they may have had some training when they were in the service, but what additional training do you give them?
There's a lot of good schools out there. I'm not going to plug anybody, but you just look up executive protection schools. There's a lot of good ones out there that put 4 to 5 day schools on that teach you the basics on executive protection. You can probably Google it, or you can probably reach me directly, mark@ledlowsecurity.com, and I can probably give you a good reference, but on the air, I'm not going to go into too much detail, but there's a lot of different companies out there. I can probably list a half a dozen, but I would recommend those veterans put them through themselves through a school, and I want to do more than, you know, 5 days, something basic that teaches, A, the movements, how to do advance, and proper motor skills, driving. Pablo, I know with PS3, he does a driving school. And a lot of your work in the bodyguard role is going to be driving because they usually package a driver and an agent that can carry a concealed weapon with that principal while on the road. And that's usually what you see is one agent does it all. You don't really see, you know, two people on a principal. They just don't want to pay the money, especially with the celebrities. That's usually coming out of the production's pocket. They don't really realize the justification for that invoice. But I would recommend going to just the basic exec protection school. And yeah, I'm sure you can Google them to find them. You know, off air, I'll probably give several referrals. But, yeah, there's several to choose from. But that's what I would do. And those veterans probably, you know, need to invest in themselves and their career. But that's a start. And then I'd go first aid. Medical is a big one. If you can become an EMT, get EMT certified, because hardly ever do you pull your gun out. I talked to James Hamilton with Kennedy Becker, and he, you know, made a good point on my podcast that, hey, how many times has the gun really been pulled or hasn't been? No one really pulls their gun out. Except protection, you don't hardly ever. And if you want a good skill set, I'd go medical, first aid, CPR, you know, even an EMT certification or paramedic.
So I always tell my kids all the time, you know, when you're selecting a career, you want to be happy. You want to really enjoy the work you're doing. So why should veterans consider doing the security work that you're doing?
It's a good transition. It's almost like it's a natural fit, protecting, you know, self-defense, military. They kind of correlate. And I would recommend anybody, instead of going celebrity dignitary, I would go corporate security. You know, there's some, you'll on LinkedIn, you'll find hundreds of different companies launching security programs like corporate security, security manager, all over LinkedIn. But there's a lot of corporations looking for some good guys, especially military background. Some of these positions pay $100,000 a year. I've even heard some of these, you know, Facebook and that, PayPal, some of those guys paying around $150,000, even more. But then you're looking at the cost of living in those areas, in those markets. But corporate security is a really good place to land if you are retiring from law enforcement or the military for that matter. And I know Gavin Becker, they're out there, they're pushing pretty hard. I know James Hamilton pretty well, and they got good programs. There's other guys out there that are doing some great programs to get people trained and all that.
That sounds great. Back to you, David.
Well, Mark, I hope we can have you on the show again in the future. This has been a great interview, and I know we're a little bit pressed for time. But before we go, and I had plugged your websites earlier, but if you could tell our guests briefly about you. You have your own podcast called Fearless Mindset Podcast. If you could tell our listeners where they can tune in, and also what else you want them to know about your company and where they can find information.
On the podcast, like you said, we have some great guests from Frank Muir, who's a business partner of mine. He's been on it several times with his daughter Bella. She's an upcoming mixed martial arts professional fighter. But the website is www.fearlessmindsetpodcast.com. And then on our iHeartRadio, just type in Mark Ludlow. And we're on Apple Podcasts as well. Amazon, just type in Mark Ludlow. We're there as well. And then YouTube, Mark Ludlow. I got a good podcast team behind me that helps me put me on all those platforms. And then if you want to reach out to me on LinkedIn, just Mark Ludlow as well. And you can find me there as well. And I'm on Instagram, the Fearless Mindset Podcast as well. So, yeah. And, I'm just helping veterans, you know, find their way, find their place. As, you know, I know the transition from the military to the civilian world is a totally different world. They're two different, like apple and banana. It took me about 2 to 3 years to go through corporate shock, culture shock, figuring out what I wanted to do and where I wanted to go.
Right. Well, thanks so much.
Here to help.
Well, thanks, Mark. And maybe we can have you on our show again sometime in the future as your schedule permits. I wish you the greatest success in your work. And thank you again. Have a great evening.
Thanks, Mark. All right. Thanks for having me, guys. You appreciate
Take care.
It. No problem.
Take care
Thank
yourself.
Sorry.
Well, that was great. I'm glad Mark was able to catch up with us this evening. And I know, Rick, we've only got 3 minutes left in our show. I just want to make a 60-second announcement and then turn back to you for our Coaching Into Care. An item of importance to a lot of veterans as they're leaving active duty, if they don't have their college degree, is they're considering going to college. I want to emphasize an important VA program. It's called Vet Success on Campus. And what the VA has put a great emphasis in the last 15 years or so in helping veterans be successful when they leave active duty and they find themselves on a college campus, which can seem a very, very different place from their day-to-day routine. So check out their Veteran Success on Campus, which they call the VSOC, V-S-O-C program. It actually started as a pilot program in 2009 at the University of South Florida in Tampa, where I got my undergraduate degree. It's expanded now to 104 schools across the country. Find out more at benefits.va.gov/VOCRehab. And if that's too long to remember, just go to va.gov, type in Vet Success in the search engine, and I'm sure you'll find it. Okay, back over to you, Rick. I know we're running out of time here.
Sure. Let me just briefly talk about the Coaching Into Care program. This program helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a rough adjustment, but your loved ones can help. Coaching Into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. The toll-free number is 1-888-823-7458. It runs from Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, the VA's Coaching Into Care number is 1-888-823-7458. Let me also remind you once again, if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs has the Veterans Crisis Line. To help, call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, that number at the Veterans Crisis Line is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
Well, it's time for us to go. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour. I'd like to thank Corey and Hurley Law Group, our sponsor, and I thank our producer, BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. Hope you'll tune in next week. Until then, have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on Veterans Issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on VBSRadio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.